chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make heaven in the middle of it. Rest make heaven in the middle. We are rest make heaven.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is not with us this evening. We really have a fine guest with us this evening. Her name is Dr. Kathleen Berry, and she's written a mind-blowing book, especially for men. And I want all you men out there in our listening audience to listen carefully to what this lady has to say. She's got a couple of doctorates besides being a nice lady, and she has a lot to say. Welcome to our program, Kathleen Berry.
Hey, thank you very much, George Butler. That's a great introduction, a good Texan introduction.
Okay. We're sort of straightforward down here in Texas. You know what I mean?
We don't pull it.
Well, you've lived here, haven't you, before or been around
Texas?
Yeah,
I lived in Amarillo back in the 1960s.
Okay. Well, then you know what Texas is like, and evidently you came away with a good feeling about Texas and Texans, right?
Oh, how can you not?
Okay, this book is entitled Unmaking War and Remaking Men, and how did you come to write this book? I know you have a doctorate in sociology and education, but you have quite a few credentials in the past, but what motivated you personally, Dr. Kathleen Berry, to write this book?
I've been working on violence against women for about 35 or 40 years, and I've done international campaigns. I've written 3 books on the subject. I've done an awful lot of work on the subject. And when we were going through the Bush regime and the Iraq War, it occurred to me that not only were we being fed a lot of lies, like we're being fed a lot of lies right now about Syria, but one of the things that really grabbed me about the news reporting on war is the frequent reference to the loss of innocent lives when civilians are killed. And, you know, I've heard that term, as you undoubtedly have, all my life, and I never thought about it, but at this particular moment it grabbed me, and I started thinking, if you designate a group of people who should not be killed and you call them innocent lives, then that means that there's another group of people who can be killed. Because otherwise, why would you designate a particular group of people who shouldn't be killed? You would say nobody should be killed. And so, of course, it took only a couple of, you know, steps in logic to arrive at the understanding that it's men in war, and now women in war, but it's mostly men, and it's a male model for war, who, not generally war, but specifically in combat, whose basic human rights are suspended while they're in combat because they can be killed and they can kill. And that's why we refer to those who can't be killed as innocent lives, to distinguish from the killable people. That really didn't set right with me. And so I began what I thought would be an article, which then became a long article, which then led me to starting to talk with men who have fought in combat and doing interviews, and pretty soon I had a book on my hands. And really wanted to explore this, not just from men in combat, but how that comes about from the socialization of young boys to combat, to those who send them in combat, those in the White House, Bush during the Iraq War, Obama now, and all of it plays into what I'm calling the masculinity of war. And also, it's really important to, this is not a U.S. phenomena. This is masculinity wherever you find it. So if, you know, if Egypt is mounting a campaign against people and starting to take innocent lives, then other men outside of the army, other men will rebel and fight back. It doesn't have to do with being Egyptian or Arab. It has to do with masculinity. It has to do with what Obama's, what's motivating Obama to send the troops into Syria, which is going to blow up the Middle East. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, you didn't interrupt your, it's fascinating. It's human nature. It gets down to the way men are, basically, but you're saying that there's a socialization process when they're very young and up to full-grown age that enhances maybe some of the aggressiveness or the sociopathic type of dynamics, or how would you describe that?
Oh, it's a really good question, George, and I really want to take it on because it's very important. Look, I've worked on violence against women for 40 some years. I know the worst kind of violence that men do and that they do to women. And now with this book, I know more about war and masculinity and combat than I ever wanted to know. But I still do not believe that this is part of human nature for men. I really believe that this is a socialization into power. And power can be, and is in fact, it can override our human nature. I find in my work, in my reading, my thinking on these issues, that what's in our human nature is a prohibition to killing other people. And when we see somebody whose life's at risk, you're driving down a highway in Texas, and you see somebody whose car is just turned over and whose life might be at risk, how can you not do something? Immediately call 911, pull over and see if there's anything you can do if you think that's our compulsion. I see somebody starting to drown at the beach. People just go in to try to rescue that person. A compulsion, not necessarily even thinking first. That's what I think is in our human nature. I think it's in our human nature to not kill other people. I think that, and I know actually from my research, that what the military does in training soldiers for combat, they have a very explicit program for overriding human nature. Because that impetus to try to save another human being comes from an empathy that we're born with. But empathy doesn't look good on macho masculinity. So men and boys try to get rid of it, try to bury it, try to not show it. To be, you know, a man. I mean, the man's man, the real guy, or whatever this business is. And when they then get into the military's training program is very explicit. It is designed to teach soldiers to kill without remorse. When you are without remorse, you have to kill the empathy that's in you. That is the beginning of PTSD for soldiers, because it's a rupture of one's humanity to kill another human being. I have had men who have been in the military as old as 85 years old, coming up to me after, you know, a talk that I've given, and with tears in their eyes, saying, "You never get over it. you never get over that experience of killing, and thank you for saying this. So I don't think that it's built into the nature of men. I think that it's built into masculine power, that is power over women, that is power over other men, stronger men over weaker men, white men over black men over their boys. It's just this repetition of masculine power that feeds on this kind of aggressiveness. And any bit of aggressiveness will trigger it off. I have an article that is out today on a website called Daily Censored, where I show how as soon as the U.S. starts to fire guns, missiles, whatever it is, into Syria, Syrian men are going to feel obliged to fight back. As soon as they fight back, we're going to get reports saying, oh, my God, Syrian men are attacking the United States. This is a war on terror. They're terrorists. This is a war on terror. We've got to really escalate this. We didn't want to, but we've got to. And Obama knows that that's the whole game plan. But the point is that men have been taught that they have to respond when there is an act of aggression against them, their family, their community, their country. And that just, you know, produces more aggression. But it's something that is taught. It's something that's socialized. Men are shamed if they are soft, if they are empathetic. There's particular names for them, like sissy or wuss or whatever. So I think I'm kind of beyond your question, but it's a
no.
Really
I think that's
one.
Boy, that's an excellent answer, Dr. Berry. Could there be something like called the false self that men are thinking in a certain way about themselves that is grandiose or some kind of godlike feeling that they have to dominate and strike back and so forth? Is there some kind of a godhead that they're seeking sometimes?
Well, I don't know if it's a godhead, but it certainly is a false self, because that's what power by force, by aggression and through violence, has got to produce a false self. I mean, it's not genuinely who we are. It's anti-human. It's harmful to others, And so, yeah, there's some construction going on of this image of who men think that they must be. But this is taken to an extreme by the U.S. military, where this false self actually becomes a kind of sociopathic personality. Because if you kill without remorse, that means you're able to kill another human being and have no feeling about it at all. Now, that's the way sociopaths behave. I don't think most of the men going into the military are sociopaths. I think that they're required to behave as if they are, so they take it on. They have to take on this identity. That's the false self that you're talking about.
Could there be a mixture of post-traumatic stress disorder combined with dissociative identity disorder, where there's been a dissociation of the person, and they're having a hard time reassociating that as a core real self?
Absolutely, absolutely, and that's what a lot of soldiers who've been in combat are struggling with, both in the military and when they come home. That's absolutely what they're dealing with, and some of them never resolve it. And when they don't, many of them, not all of them, but many of them will continue to perpetuate violence. And it will be, you know, on their families, the people close to them in their communities. You know, this country is overrun with violence at this point. This kind of random violence, shooting in schools, it's just overrun with it. And you have to be dissociated from yourself to be able to do that kind of thing. You have to be really harmed in some very deep way.
Have you looked at psychotropic drugs or psychiatry drugs as perpetuating or helping to nurture those kinds of dynamics?
I haven't looked at that, but I don't have much use for them in terms of what we're talking about, because I think that there's certain kinds of things that, you know, such as antidepressants or anti-anxiety medication that might be needed in an emergency situation to bring that, to dial down, you know, the really bad, bad feelings. But the use of drugs over a long time tends to replace the process of getting a hold of oneself. You know, and it will go on from there into alcohol and into hard drug use. I'm not against all of the drugs that come out, but I think that they have to be combined with really solid programs. And I see very, very little that's out there that's willing to address the real dangers that are inculcated in masculinity itself. You know, my position is really, really clear that we are not going to get rid of war as long as masculinity remains unchanged. We're not going to end violence against women. We're not going to have peace in this world until masculinity is changed. And that's a very deep process, but it's one that could happen very quickly if more and more men got involved with this. There are groups of men and programs by men to make these changes, involved in making these changes. And they're doing really good work, but they need a huge, huge, huge amount of support and reaching out, an ability to reach out to larger and larger groups of men. And I think it's ultimately that kind of social support that takes one away from feeling isolated and kind of crazy for having done things you would have never done if you hadn't gone into the military, you know, and kind of a self-hatred that can come.
Yeah, there's a lot of guilt associated with some of these people. In fact, I believe we have more suicides than we have combat deaths right now.
I've heard the statistics are very alarming. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me right now, but the statistics are very, very alarming. And, you know, just on that point, when every veteran or soldier that I interviewed and every testimony I read or I heard from soldiers who have been in combat, comes down to, every one of them comes down to, they all use the same word. They talk, when they get to the point where they talk about killing someone, or in military speak, their first kill, they all say that's the moment that they felt they lost their soul. And this is not in any religious context. I really take this to be referring to, there's a fabric of our being, our humanity, that can't be pushed past a certain point. And when it is, which is what the military does to these combat soldiers, is to push them past that certain point, there's a breaking of one's humanity. And I know a lot of men have done wonderful work in pulling themselves out of that. But I think we've also got to get into the high schools and get to the young people to get them to not go in the beginning, to not let that happen to them, because that starts with basic training. In fact, one soldier said to me that he left the military, he joined up against his mother's wishes. His mother was crying when he left home. Oh, no, he wanted to go and fight for his country. This was the Iraq War. And when they took, in basic training, when they took him out to a firing range, And he picked up the gun and realized that he could see the target, but he couldn't tell what it was. And said to himself, "My God, that could be another human being." And he put down the gun and said he wouldn't do it. And he became a conscientious objector, which is not a very easy thing. Boy, that's a real trial and tribulation for a guy in the military to do. But he was very courageous.
Yeah, we have one of my little sayings I've written over the years is that. Old bulls don't fight.
Mm-hmm.
And young men, you know, and they're coming up in America, and they're taught by their parents or their fathers or something to stand up for yourself, you know, and don't let people push you around and don't let anyone bully you, right?
Right.
And in fact, when I was growing up, just a short little blip here. We used to have a fun room where we went dancing in the fifth and sixth grade at a junior high school. We were young fifth and sixth graders, but at a junior high together. Mm-hmm. And we had what we call a fun room. We used to dance there on Friday nights. Well, if two boys got into trouble or had a fight, they'd take them into the gym right next door, put boxing gloves on, and they would slug it out.
Uh-huh.
And then they would just, we had big gloves, so we couldn't hurt each other, you know, and then they would take the gloves off, we'd shake hands, and we'd go back in and dance with the little girls.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, that was a Texas solution in the late 50s or so, 56 or so. But anyway, men need a natural way to expend some of that extra energy, do they not? I mean, like physical sports and things, isn't that a way to take away some of that aggression and so forth?
Yeah, go out and jog every day. Jog morning and evening if you've got too much of it. Go out and play baseball. We're finding right now that football is really a parallel to military in terms of harmfulness to men and boys. With the brain injury that's now becoming recognized as commonplace in football. And so that's one that I would really not recommend. But why not soccer then instead, or any number of sports, you know, athletic activities, there's a lot of things that can be done. If you really want to use up your energy, I have a cousin who lives in Texas, Houston. He lives in Houston. And he and his daughter go every Sunday to the shelter that provides meals for homeless people. And they spend the day helping cook the meals and serving the meals and talking to the people and cleaning up. That's a lot of energy. It's
yes.
A lot better use of energy.
Well, Kathleen, that's the way to do is take all of these aggressions and transform them into something good for other people.
Go out and march against.
Yeah.
Go out and march against Obama's invasion.
Right.
Planned
right.
invasion
well,
into Syria.
You know, we're part of the alternative, media, especially we have a very strong group here in Austin, but we're not for the invasion of Syria. It's surprising, but there's a certain conservative alternative press type of group, and I'm part of that we're standing up against these kinds of actions.
That's really great. And you know what? For once, we're the majority of Americans.
Yes.
The other day there was a poll conducted and it showed that, and this was a couple days ago, I think it's much higher right now. A few days ago, 48% Americans were against going into Syria, against Obama's plan. Only 29% were in favor. And right now the House of Representatives is really tilting. I mean, they're really in the balance and not quite knowing what direction they're going. So this is a time to have you all be calling your representatives and insisting that they vote no on the war in Syria. I don't know if Obama will try to go it alone because he's going to be pretty isolated. But he's got a full court press on this with the Congress right now, so we've got to do the same.
Well, you know, I agree with that. Go ahead. What were you
going to
say?
Well, I wanted to get to, in my book, I'm Making War, Remaking Men,
sure.
I talk about, toward the end of that book, the kinds of things that men are doing to change masculinity as it is right now. And the kind of process that they go through. So there's a lot that we can see that's really, really positive that's happening in this area. And I think it's really important, and again, this is in my book, I go into great detail in it, about why it's not human nature for males to be aggressive. I think that's a really bad rap for men to have to carry. And to show that it's really something that's a product of the culture and the society, which means we can change it.
Right. Your website is KathleenBarry, BARRY.net. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
So that's KathleenBarry.net, KathleenBarry.net. And you can find your book there, and you have a marvelous site. You have a nice bio, you have events coming up, press kits, articles and things like that. And what can men start doing to transform this aggressive, warlike nature that we have? What can we do to try to get to be more peace-like? And I started out as a young man, you know, full of fire, and just like you described, you know,
mm-hmm.
these men going to war. I went in the Army. I didn't get to Vietnam because of paralyzed my right arm in the meantime, between being called back in, see. But
mm-hmm.
anyway, I was one of these egotistical young men and thought about myself before I thought about others. But the sexual drives that men have, they really interfere with us a lot of time, do they not?
Oh, sure they do. They interfere with women and girls, too.
Yes, yes.
And that's something that they really have to either work it off or control it, or do both. I don't believe that we're of the same species, the human species.
Right.
I don't believe that men have to parade themselves as uncontrollable. And I think it's very cowardly to take that kind of position and hold it. Find ways to deal with things. We do. Women do. You know, but anyway, you're asking about what to do about this. I don't want to kind of sound like I'm just self-promoting, but
yeah.
When I was writing Unmaking War, Remaking Men, I was dreaming that it would get into the hands of high school students, college students, young people, men, and young women too, because women are starting to sign up. But it's not ever going to be a women's military. If it is, it'll be a totally different kind of place. Because I've written it in such a way as to show the real harm that will come to anyone who enlists in the military as it is today. And so that's the first thing. I think then taking that, I would like to see there be more programs and communities and really widely publicized programs where men are coming together to change their masculinity. You might have seen on my website, I'm offering a program that is called Making Change. And it involves, it starts with cultivating empathy. I did this program recently in a college and I had about 60 or 80 students show up, and the majority of them were men, and they responded so beautifully. My heart just filled with hope when I left there, because
right.
they got it, you know. I did this first section on empathy, and everything I dreamed of when I was writing the book was happening in that section. And then I talk about it in terms of when you take empathy and put it up against power, you then have to change your consciousness, not just your feelings of remorselessness, but in bringing about empathy, but you have to change your consciousness. And once you do that, you need to have plans for what to do with it. So I have this program that I do wherever I get invited to do it. And I tell you, it's just been heart-rending to me to see the responses. It's not difficult to get women in an audience to engage with empathy. It may be more difficult to get them to engage with strategies to make change, but the resistance is more from the young men. But I've found no resistance at all. And really, they stayed afterwards. You know, they had classes to go to, and some people had to run out because they had required classes they had to get to. But most of them just stayed and stayed on and wanted to keep going. It was very exciting. And so I think that kind of thing needs to keep happening with, you know, wherever it can be done and with whoever can do it.
In the corporate world, you know, women have this glass ceiling that they're bumping their heads up against continually. But then in trying to break through that, do women try to emulate men in the way they are? And that seems like a tragic thing that, you know, if they do.
Whether it's the corporate world or the Congress or the U.S. military, it's not that women are trying to emulate men. It is that the systems they go into are constructed by and for men, and the only way that they can succeed in their own eyes, and is the way they've been told, is to be like men. And that's the real tragedy of women trying to get into these different, you know, different places. I was thinking the other day about, we've got so many more women in Congress right now, but I'm not seeing them showing up with their no votes for this war that Obama wants to have in Syria. I'm seeing them being hard-headed about wanting to show that they can be as tough as any of the guys. They can really think tough, too. And that's because they're in a male system, and they learn in that male system that if they don't play it the guy's way, they're not going to get to play it at all. And that's got to change, and it is changing slowly. And some women are making a huge difference. But that's where the problem is. The problem isn't with the women. It's what they think they have to do in order to make it in a man's world, because they've been told by men that that's what they have to do. I can't tell you the number of times I got in trouble when I was a professor for not playing it the men's way. You know, and so you either get in trouble, which I was in most of the time, or you play it their
way. You were a little mischievous professor, weren't you?
Well, you owe it to your students, don't you? You owe it to your students to show them the
But you had a good time, didn't you?
Well, I have to admit. It
was interesting.
Yeah, I have to admit. I liked kind of changing things there.
There was a saying, Alexander Solzhenitsyn said something like, the battle line between good and evil runs through the human heart. What would be your comments along that line?
Wow, that is really beautiful.
And, you know, he spent 9 years in, you know, as a political prisoner in Russia, wrote 3 volumes of Gulag Archipelago, which I've read. But, you know, I know we touched on human nature earlier and so forth, but, gosh, I think we got to point to each individual, too, as being responsible for the way they are, right, and hold them their feet to the fire and say, hey, it's you are the problem. That's what I finally realized was about 39 or 40, I started going out and jogging and thinking about the world and myself. And I round at the end of a jogging session one day, I looked in the mirror. I said, by God, George, I am the problem. Men are the problem in this world the way we are.
You know,
see what
that's
I mean?
The beginning.
I finally realized that the way that we are, we can't see it. See, it's a delusion that hides a delusion sort of type thing.
Right. Yeah. It's,
and it's hard for us to understand and to see the way that we are.
Yeah. That's why this kind of approach of empathy really works. Because in order to be empathetic with others, you have to be able to be empathetic with yourself. In order to be empathetic yourself, you have to see yourself the way you are.
Yes.
Not the way that power has allowed you to think of yourself.
Right.
And
right.
It seems like that what you had at that point was a very intense moment of consciousness raising. We call it the aha moment.
Right.
You know, where
right.
you actually did have this moment where you could see yourself the way you are, not you, not just you individually, but you men the way you are.
Yes.
And
yes.
see that has to change. And, you know, I mean, God, I wouldn't have, 20 years ago, I wouldn't have imagined being able to hear men saying that this, not to mention having an hour-long conversation on a conservative radio program about it. I mean, it's just things are really are changing, and you're part of the hope for the future because you have that consciousness, then you want to do something about it. Then you saw the thing that I wrote on Daily Censored and called
yes.
me this morning. I mean, it all of this, and now people are listening to it. And those who are not angry by it are going to go and talk to other people about it, talk to their sons about it. You know, this is how it goes. This is how things change, happens. In feminism, we have this saying that the personal is political. And it really turns around all of the political ordering of things, which keeps political separated from who we are as human beings. And we say as feminists, that, you know, we demand the freedom from sexual violence because we personally experience that. That is a political problem for us. We personally experience the removal of freedom to control our own bodies. That becomes a political problem. And likewise, I mean, this is no more so than masculinity itself being the personal is political.
You studied this white trafficking and things like that, white slavery?
Yeah, it's actually called trafficking in women.
Okay, and what all did you insights did you finally come out of that with? What could you broach with us on the air about some of your keen insights?
You know, I'd like to give you a couple minutes about on this because some things that have happened recently are actually very hopeful along these lines. When I first started writing about trafficking in women, it was around 1975, and I saw it as an extension of violence against women, where trafficking women are being trafficked to be sold, to be then used in prostitution. And then I began to realize that the term trafficking in women it's actually being used now very powerfully, but there's something about it that's kind of a misnomer because it suggests that when one is trafficked for prostitution, it's wrong, but when one goes out her door and goes out onto the street and gets bought for prostitution, that's something different. It's not trafficking. And so what I did was put it all together and say, okay, when I bring all this together, what is the experience of a woman who is being purchased to be used by a man for sex in whatever way he wants to do it, whatever he's going to do to her? what is that experience? And when you look at it, you see it as prostitution is just repetitive rape that's paid for. And so what I ended up doing was calling this female sexual slavery, because it has all the dynamics that we see around wife abuse, where women who are being abused in their homes will tell you that they love their husbands, that they there's no reason for them to leave, that he didn't mean to do it, and he said he'd never do it again, and over and over again. And that's the same thing that women in prostitution say. Now, what has happened since I wrote that in 1975 is I did some international projects with the United Nations and UNESCO about focusing not on the women, but on the men who buy, and making it a crime for men to buy sex, for anyone to buy sex off of another human being, but it just happens to be, doesn't just happen to be, the power of masculinity makes it that men, that's what men do, is buy sex off of another human being. What I'm really happy to report is that this law has been in place and very, very successful now in about 10 countries in the world, where the incidence of trafficking has just virtually gone away. You can't traffic women to be sold in a country where men will get put in jail and fined for buying them. I mean, it's just not a good market commodity practice. And at the same time, these laws also provide for the women and provide shelter programs with retraining, with psychological counseling, with help, support in that, because most of these women are really, really need an awful lot of care psychologically and in terms of their health, and, you know, some kind of job training, help with job placement. Because almost every woman in prostitution will tell you that she would do anything if she could get another job to get out of prostitution. And so there's an economic factor there. Anyway, this has become a new abolitionist movement. And now, instead of abolishing all the laws on prostitution, we're abolishing prostitution. And it's dramatically decreased in the countries that have developed it, have used this law. And it's being heard in parliaments and in different places all over this country, coming up in different states and municipalities, and all over the world right now. So it's a really fantastic change.
Well, you must be commended to having accomplished that.
Well, I'm not sure I've accomplished it, but it's happening, and so. We have huge numbers of people seeing the whole thing in a different way now. We have a huge decrease in men dying women for prostitution. And this is putting the pressure where it belongs on the state and communities to help these women find respectful, well-paying jobs.
Right. There's a question in here on one of your sites here. It says, I'll just read it word for word. What is demilitarization why is demilitarization not a sufficient condition for peace either in a nation state or in the world?
Yeah, that's, that is one of these big, somebody wrote a thing on something to me on Facebook today. I was criticizing somebody's, what they were saying, and somebody else wrote back and said, yes, Kathleen, that what they're talking about it's actually just magical thinking. That's magical thinking, to think that you militarize a country, militarize a state, and then you won't have war. You provide men with bullets and guns and machines and planes and bombs and nerve gas and they won't want to use it?
Yeah.
Need I say more? You know, it really is a kind of magical thinking. What we have seen, for example, Costa Rica is a very good example of a country that had a very extremely violent coup d'etat in, I think it was in the 40s, the 1940s. And it was bloody, and huge numbers of Costa Ricans were killed. The dictatorship was overthrown. The new president took office, and he immediately said, we will never have another war in Costa Rica again because we will not have a military. And that's been true. Believe it or not, that's been true since 1946 or 47. They don't have a military. They're not backed by anybody else's military. So if they're attacked, you know, another country has agreed to come in or something like that. Their boys are not raised. They're still macho. We still have to work on that side of it. But they're not raised to go into the military. And they have had no wars. I mean, Nicaragua's, there have been occasional incursions from Nicaragua into Costa Rica, but nothing holds. Nothing, the wars just don't happen. And people will immediately say, well, Costa Rica's a small state, it's in Latin America, it's different than the United States. I would venture to say that the bigger we are, the more likely it would be to work. Because
right.
We're the ones who can attack everybody because we're the biggest. So if we stopped attacking anybody, it's more likely to work. And if we stopped attacking anybody, then we would seriously diminish our military.
Right. In Mexico, you have men running these drug cartels.
Oh,
and,
yes.
And there's a lot of power there and money, right? Dominance.
Right.
And killing and psychopathic behavior. What is there any hope to straighten that up, or what? How would we ever even reach out to some of these people down there?
I think some of the countries in Latin America have been able to move forward on this, but I think that it requires a re-envisioning of the state itself. And what the function of the state is and what the responsibilities of the state are, and to break the state away from the criminals, because there's undoubtedly collusion going on there. And, of course, it was all coming through Mexico because it started, I mean, the really bad place was Colombia. But the countries around Colombia have become socialist countries, which is probably a really evil word on a conservative radio program.
Oh, that is.
But
okay, go ahead.
Yeah, take a deep breath, everybody.
Yeah, I'm taking a deep breath out here in all my listening audience, which lost, right? No, I didn't.
Right there.
Yeah, but no, we understand these dynamics. Go ahead, continue your thoughts there.
I think that it's what I see and what we know about what makes things work in these states has been a change in values and a change in a sense of people's responsibility for each other. You know, we are losing that so rapidly in the United States. We seem to be responsible for buying things, and that seems to be our primary responsibility. In fact, both Obama and Bush, when the market went down at different times, said the best thing you can do for your country right now is to get out and buy. And, it's crass. It's really, really crass. I'm not proposing a different economic system. I'm proposing a different value system, where we look at people with a different kind of worth. And this comes back to my my theme about empathy. In fact, the subtitle of my book, Unmaking War, Remaking Men, the subtitle is, empathy, where empathy can, you know, change our politics, our soldiers, and ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I see that as something that is powerfully missing in our country. And one of the reasons it's powerfully missing is that we have let our economy drive us. We are no longer driving our economy. It is driven by it is driving us. And so we then let people's homes go into foreclosure and go living on the street but pay off banks to stay into business. And people seem to think that that's okay. And that's what I mean by a change in values. You know, I don't want to see the U.S. economy collapse, but for me, it has collapsed. When all those people lost their homes and are living on, you know, living on the streets and going to soup kitchens now and being treated by our government officials as if they're just not willing to work.
Right.
There's a hatred of other people, of people who are not well off in our country. And that's what I mean by looking at some of the neighbors in Latin America, where that kind of hatred is not tolerated. If it's not tolerated, then those cartels are going to have a hard time growing up in the communities.
Right.
And siphoning, because they're siphoning off the young men. You know, the young men who aren't going into the military, they're siphoning young men off the streets, and they're preying on poverty,
right.
You know, and it's, and so I really look for a very deep change in values in this country.
Well, you know, from the right, okay, what the way that we, that I myself and others like myself picture the capitalistic system is one that is monopolistic capitalism and not really free market capitalism that's fair to everyone. And I believe in that concept that the liberal has from the left, they see capitalism as not good. See what I mean?
And yeah,
I do. But we also from the right see that there's this good old boy crony capitalism, you know, Federal Reserve, privately owned, and all that, and we're working against that so that we can free up this free market system and benefit everyone, see?
See, that's where we probably are closer than we are further apart.
Yeah,
because
right.
Because if you look at a country like Sweden, which is a social democracy, and they provide, they do have health care for all, which I think, you know, the United States is alone in the world in our refusal to be, and being the wealthiest country in the world, but yet refusing to provide health care for all human beings when we have, you know, a monopoly on health care otherwise. But at the same time, what you have is a well-functioning market economy in Sweden. But it's not this kind of runaway capitalism that is just, you know, feeding CEOs, feeding banks, and with CEOs starting to take on the characteristics of sociopaths.
Well, you know, yeah, you make some good points there on this, on the health care system in this country. The problem with that is that you've got this modern medical model that is this profit-driven, but is not using alternative means and preventive types of measures to prevent illness. So,
right.
See, and what where I differ with Michael Moore is that he puts on the table all these socialist models of health care, but does not get down to the real core problems that are closer to a eugenics-based health care system than one that is helpful to us.
Yeah, I think that there's two parts to that, and
yeah.
And I agree with you in part. I think that the most urgent need is to get health care to people who need it, And as we're getting health care to people who need it right away, I mean, you know, if you've got a bleeding ulcer, you don't want somebody coming to talk to you about how to prevent that bleeding ulcer. You want somebody to take care of it first, you know.
And
so we need the health care to people really urgently who need it. And as we're providing that, building up a preventative system, and one that's fair, but one that treats all human beings with a right to live in human dignity. That's the first clause of the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, that we are all born to live in human dignity and human rights. And
The only thing that I would differ with you on that is that those were given by men to other men, and there is a clause in there that says that that can be taken back from you if you do not conform to the United Nations laws and regulations.
No.
Yeah.
I studied it.
23C, check that out.
Okay,
and,
I will.
You know, you check it out because we've looked at this thing, and we're coming from a conservative thought of viewpoint here are natural law and natural rights. See what I mean? Where nobody and no man can ever take those rights from you, see? But they were not bestowed on you by other men, see? That's where a real conservative, and when I say conservative, I'm not talking about someone that's not compassionate. My view is I'm very compassionate to people, but I'm trying to reform this money system. This money system has just fueled this corruption that we have.
Yes.
And you're suffering, your people on the left, and my people on the right. We're all suffering, so we need to come together and not be divided. And I believe forgiveness can bring us together.
I think forgiveness, but I think just plain understanding, because I think in this conversation it's fairly clear that we're not that far apart, and I don't represent myself as being from the left. I, as a feminist and as a woman, men from the left and the right rape women. Men from the left and right hold power over women. There's no class of men that
don't think
they're superior to all women.
Well, you're very, Kathleen, you're very fair, whether you're talking about George W. Bush or the Obama administration. Both have done some dreadful things, see? And so that's where, you know, you're very fair-minded and balanced there. We've got to close out here in just a second. Were there any final comments you would like to make? Got about a minute.
I just want to repeat my website is KathleenBerry.net, or it's UnmakingWar.net, and my book is Unmaking War, Remaking Men, How Empathy Can Reshape Our Politics, Our Soldiers, and Ourselves. And I want to thank you very much, George, for your commitment and this thing about men remaking themselves.
Okay, well, I'm trying to remake myself, but it's awful hard sometimes.
Oh, it's hard for all of us.
Okay.
for all of us.
Okay.
But I really commend you and what you're doing and what you're saying, and I've enjoyed talking with you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Berry, for being with us this evening, and good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.